This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The goal for researchers working on prosthetics has been to give back as much as possible of what an amputee has lost. There have been many great strides in improving prosthetic movement in recent years. What's the latest frontier in this research? Recreating pain. Engineers created the sensation from a new kind of synthetic skin. So far, it's been tested on the fingertips of a prosthetic hand. Luke Osborne is a graduate student in biomedical engineering at Johns Hopkins University. He's the co-author of a paper on this new research and joins us now. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about this. How does this synthetic skin work?
Sure. So what we created is what we're calling an electronic dermis, an e-dermis, if you will. And dermis is another name for skin. And what we do is we put this e-dermis on the fingertips of a prosthesis, and in that e-dermis are sensors, and those sensors pick up pressure. And what we're able to do is look at if that pressure is something that is innocuous, so something that's not painful, or maybe it's something potentially damaging and painful, such as a sharp pinprick.
Oh, wait, now this is interesting because we're already doing this. So under normal conditions, we sense pressure. And if I can be sort of schematic about this, if it's a big round thing that is pressing against my finger, brain says no problem. But if it's pointed, the brain says this could penetrate the skin, that'll be a problem. And this is what triggers the pain response. And pain tells me to get my finger out of there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We use pain as a protective mechanism, and it's a lot of times we take it for granted because it's something that we don't always want to experience or feel, but it's actually really valuable because it protects our bodies from damage by giving us these sensations. And so with this e-dermis, what we're trying to do is see if we can detect that sharp pressure and differentiate that from something that's, say, nice and rounded, like you just mentioned.
Now, the way it works in all of us is that adaptively, right, for survival purposes, we don't want to think too much about a very dangerous situation. So to bypass all of that quandary over how sharp it is and whether or not this is really dangerous, the brain just says, ouch, yank. If I have a prosthetic hand, can't I be more deliberate about the problem that I have? In other words, will the amputee experience what I consider pain, that is, that unpleasant experience that makes me yank my hand?
Right, to some extent. So we did two things. One is we gave this pain information to the prosthesis itself so it could perform that pain reflex, that yanking away from something that's damaging. But we also wanted to give the user the sense of what the prosthesis itself was feeling. And so we were able to do that by providing stimulation of the peripheral nerves in the residual limb of an amputee. And they were able to feel sensations of both pressure and pain.
Mm. So they would experience it as pain. They would yell, ouch, or worse.
Right. And that's right. So we had to be careful about this because obviously you don't want to make it extremely uncomfortable for the volunteer. So what we did is a bunch of experiments called psychophysics, which is where we provide some stimulation to the nerves and we ask them questions like, what did you feel? Or was that painful or not? Or on a scale of 1 to 10, how painful was it? And by doing this over and over again, we can build up a better idea of what it is they perceive when we provide these sensations. Because we don't just want to provide pain, we're also providing sensations of pressure as well.
Right. Why do this? I mean, again, we can understand why I don't want my finger to bleed, but if I have a prosthetic hand, that's not an issue. Why provide a sensation, again, that most of us don't want?
That's a good question, and it really comes down to what we're trying to do with this research is create more lifelike prosthetic limbs, and that includes sensations of both pressure and pain. And if you think about it, a prosthesis isn't able to heal itself the same way somebody with an intact hand may be able to. So if you damage your skin, say with a cut, eventually your skin will heal itself. With a prosthesis, it doesn't have that self-healing ability just quite yet, so by providing the user some indication that what they're handling is potentially damaging to the prosthesis, it in a way helps make their device a little more lifelike.
So it's got this very practical application of preserving the prosthetic, or helping the individual preserve that. But it also does seem to me to have deep philosophical implications. Part of what I've lost is the sense of pain, which was part of my experience as a human. I mean, is this any part of you're a researcher into this prosthetic device, and I wonder if this is any part of your thinking or the thinking that goes into this, that restoring the fullness of human experience, including pain, is part of what you're all about.
Frank, you're absolutely right. And what's really interesting is research has shown that even by just providing some sensation of even just pressure back to an amputee, it really helps what's called embodiment of their device. So they are better able to perceive their phantom hand, which is the hand that's no longer there, but they can still feel it. And by giving these sensations back through a prosthesis, users can start to embody their device. They start to see it as their own limb. And so the thought is, by incorporating more realistic sensations, not just pressure, but pain as well, and hopefully in the future, things like temperature and texture, you're really creating something that can be fully incorporated by the user as not necessarily just a tool, but an extension of their natural body.
This is interesting. I wonder, this raises the question in my mind at the moment about proprioception. Now, there's the sense of we kind of know, even though we're not conscious of it, where all of our limbs are at any given moment. If you want to pick up a cup of coffee, you need to know where your hand is to begin with. Brain's already got that worked out. Is that a problem for is that lost with people who have prosthetics, and can it be restored by these kinds of sensations, this edermis?
Right. Yeah. So that is a sensation that's lost, and that's something that a lot of users will comment on. So typically, what happens is an amputee, if they're using a prosthetic hand, will have to keep an eye on it and watch where it moves as they pick up or manipulate objects, and that way they know what's happening. But somebody with an intact limb, you don't necessarily have to look at that. And there are a couple things going on, but it's primarily that proprioception as well as your touch feedback. So everything is working together to give you this really great sensation of where your limb is in space. And so with proprioception, that's a little bit trickier because you have both muscles that are active as well as sensory nerves that are providing this information. And so for providing that type of information back to an amputee, it becomes a little more challenging.
It's interesting, too, because you're working, again, with the network that's already in the individual. You're connecting this to the nervous system of the individual. But you got to do a little programming on your side to teach your device or your dermis the difference between sharp and blunt and pressure and, you know, more and less. So you're doing a little programming on your end. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And not only do we have to tell the prosthesis what's happening through this programming, we also have to figure out what's the right way to stimulate an amputee so that they can feel these sensations. And so we spend a lot of time going through these experiments where we will provide some sensation and we try to document it best we can to figure out, okay, what is the absolute best way to stimulate these nerves if we want to give them a sensation of maybe pressure in their thumb or maybe pain. And so what we're able to do is use what's called a neuromorphic model, which is a fancy way of saying we look at what biology does to help motivate the way we program these devices. And so we can look at how receptors in our skin behave and how they send information back to the nervous system and try to match that.
That's interesting. Yeah, because you said the best way, and here I am thinking kind of very bluntly, well, it's an electrical signal. You just send, you know, so many microvolts and it'll work. But apparently you're saying it's far more complicated than that.
Yeah, just a little bit, because if you look at how receptors in our skin work, they send this electrical activity through our nerves to our spinal cord and then up to our brain, which is where we perceive things like pressure or pain and temperature. And we know more or less what these signals look like. But when somebody's amputated, they no longer have those receptors in their hand because they no longer have a hand. But those nerves still exist. So what we're trying to do is see if we can match what used to happen going into those nerves by programming the prosthesis controller, which is essentially a little computer that sits within the limb that sends out this type of information.
But that's fascinating, because that means your research will tell us more about our nervous system, but also how pain works and how all of this sensory data is actually constructed, because it's only going through, you know, these pathways and then more or less gets constructed in the brain. I mean, the fact is, if you were in a deep sleep and somebody hit your thumb with a hammer, your thumb is not going to experience the pain. Your brain experiences the pain. Your thumb just said, I got hit by a hammer. What do we do about this, right?
That's right. That's right. And a big and interesting question that still persists is, how do people perceive these sensations? Right. The few people we have worked with, everyone's a little bit different. Right. So we spend time catering to the individual more or less to better understand what it is that we as humans perceive, and then does that change after an amputation, or is there a way of recovering some of those natural sensations?
Interesting. And I assume you're moving on. You will look to cover more of the body if this is successful?
That's right. And it's, you know, can you provide these sensations from more than just the hand, but then also better understanding what type of perceptions are even possible after an amputation. So, you know, the first big steps were in providing sensory feedback in general. A couple of years ago, great research was done all across the world where people could provide sensations of pressure, and now we're able to do pain. But there are other sensations such as textures and, like you had mentioned, proprioception and even temperature that still haven't quite been figured out just yet.
Fascinating stuff. Luke Osborne, a graduate student in biomedical engineering at Johns Hopkins University, co-author of a paper on new research on the development of a synthetic skin for prosthetics that helps an amputee feel pain. Luke Osborne, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. We're talking about pain, electrical impulses to the brain, mostly constructed there, so it is all in your head, and that makes it very important. We'll talk more about pain on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. So we just talked about a technological development that allows amputees to feel pain through a synthetic skin, sends electrical signals to the brain when the skin touches a sharp surface. Actually, any surface, but it will distinguish between sharp and blunt. But pain is more than electrical impulses, and it's more than physical sensation. It is all about context and about construction of pain, and that all happens in the brain. Seema Pettidar is a pain pathologist at UNC Pain Management Center, also an assistant professor of anesthesiology at UNC School of Medicine, and she joins us now. Seema Pettidar, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks to have me.
Tell us more about what you do. You say pain is a stimulus. I mean, obviously, we sort of have some idea. Something happens to, you know, our body, and then it goes. What do we know about pain and kind of how it works?
So pain is ultimately a physical stimulus that activates our nervous system. And so, you know, you put your hand on a hot stove, it's your nervous system that's activated, and you interpret pain in your brain. Like you'd said earlier, it is in our head. And so the context of the situation, how we perceive that pain, is impacted by a lot of different factors in our environment as well as within ourselves.
So what are the things that can change how we react to pain or how we receive pain?
So even just the context of how long we think it will last. You know, if we know it's going to be short term, we may be able to push through and feel like we can tolerate it better. If we think it's going to be helpful to us, if, you know, you go to the dentist and the numbing agent causes you pain, but you know it's saving you from the greater pain of having a tooth pulled, it's worth it to you. So how we perceive the purpose or the function of that pain can impact, you know, what we do as a result.
Now, sadly, we never see pain as a good thing, although it is always telling us something important, right?
Yeah, it always serves a function. Typically, pain is a signal that tells us we're in danger. It keeps us safe. It's an adaptive mechanism. And the problem is we usually pay attention to pain when it becomes maladaptive, when it really becomes dysfunctional. So think of like a house alarm. It's supposed to keep you safe. If there's an intruder, it should go off. So that's ultimately this how our nervous system is responding to pain. However, if that system just keeps going off, then you don't know if you're in danger, and it becomes really annoying.
Right. Well, what are some of the other, we talked about context, the fact that I've experienced a pain maybe before, I mean, if people have chronic migraines, for instance, and you start feeling the migraine coming on, I mean, is there the anticipation of a previously experienced pain that can make things worse?
Yeah, it can be a familiar pattern. And so you can interpret that as I know what's going to happen and I'm okay. I know it will end. Or you can interpret it as, I know this is going to happen next, so I need to prepare for it to be that bad. We have patients who are going to have procedures done, and before they even have the procedure, they see the needle and they already feel the response because of the pain. And so they have some insight to know that the needle has not touched them yet, but they physiologically have a response, and that's that stress response.
This is going to sound horrible. I love my mother. She did a great job. That was back in the spanking era, but here's the trick, and she brags about this trick. I would do something bad pretty much on the hour, and she would say, I'm going to spank you, and it's going to hurt. And she would like talk about how much it's going to hurt, and then more or less make some noise with the back of her hand. And by golly, it hurt.
You know?
So that was a great trick.
And it's basic behavioral conditioning.
Yeah.
And so we know that that can happen, where people experience something a certain way enough times, or something reminds them of a memory, that the impact it has physiologically may be greater than what's happening in the moment.
So what's your job like? Because you're a pain psychologist, right?
Mm-hmm.
People don't like to be told it's all in their head.
No, and they also don't like the idea of seeing a psychologist, right? Usually. There's such a stigma with mental health care, and patients with chronic pain face stigma all the time as well. So it's kind of a compounded sort of fear of having to see the psychologist. I will say in our clinic, our providers do a great job of normalizing it, that we readdress pain from both the physical and mental perspective, that we don't leave it all to one thing. And so in order to be effective, we need to pay attention to both. And I try to tell patients, you know, for everybody, pain impacts your mood. Your mood's also going to impact how you cope with pain. It just looks different for each person. And we want to take a comprehensive approach. And if we ignore your quality of life and the impact of pain on you as a person and your life around you, then we're not really paying attention to everything that we need.
So when you pay attention, how do you pay attention, and what are some of the recommendations that you can give people? Because, you know, clearly they're all in different circumstances.
Yeah.
Right?
One of the first things I think we do as psychologists is pay attention to where a person is in their life. You know, we want to take, as health psychologists, take a biopsychosocial approach. So we want to pay attention to the biological factors, psychological factors, and social factors in someone's life and how they're coping with any chronic illness. And it's especially important for chronic pain because of that mind-body interaction. And it's very, as you've already kind of mentioned, is very important for the pain experience. So it's getting to know them. You know, why do they want their pain to stop? Where is it stopping them in participating in their life? What's valuable or important to them? What do they think they can do? How have they coped with stress before? Are those coping skills still there? And helping them use what they already have to do well. And in the context of psychology, I know a lot of patients have these perceptions of what it means to see a psychologist. As a health psychologist, we're focused on the impact of your health. You don't have to have a severe mental illness or mental health diagnosis to benefit from support when you get knocked down by your health.
Well, it's not only the stigma that might be attached to mental health services, but also the thought that in my case, and I've seen 40 doctors now, and I have not gotten a diagnosis, and my back mm-hmm. still hurts, and now they're telling me to see you, which is to say, my back doesn't hurt if I would just, sit on a cushion and ohm a few times,
yeah.
It'll go away. And that could be rough for people, right?
And it's the idea that I can never know what your pain feels like. Mm. It doesn't mean it's not there.
Well, I want to bring another expert into the conversation right now. William Meixner is the president of the American Pain Society. He's a professor of anesthesiology at Duke University School of Medicine and co-director of the Center for Translational Pain Medicine, and he joins us now. Welcome to State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. Pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. You're dealing now and looking at ways of treating people with chronic pain, right?
Correct.
And what are some of the ways in which the treatment of chronic pain and the kind of research that you're doing has changed over the past few decades?
Yeah, I think in many ways there have been changes which have been built upon the last 50 years of knowledge and discovery with respect to concepts, theoretical models for chronic pain. I think, as noted, we now begin to think of chronic pain in the context of a biopsychosocial model, and not simply acute pain is perceived or thought about, where there's a peripheral stimulus, then there's a bell that goes off in the brain, and the individual perceives pain. We now recognize that the vast majority of chronic pain patients truly experience pain, but there is a overlay well beyond the pain processing system that relates to psychological and social variables that we now know can influence the development of the brain, the development of circuitry within the brain, and the susceptibility of the individual to persistent pain. So I think it's now more and more recognized that the patient's genetics, intrinsic genetics that they receive from mom and dad, as well as their history of life events, those two variables interact to create a very complex patient at times, where they have not only the susceptibility to pain following what many would perceive as a minor situation, but also they develop a variety of affective components related to anxiety, depression, the way in which the body senses information, like we heard earlier with the prosthesis, that these events really reach the brain, but they're conditioned by the genetics and environmental factors that develop the overall brain. Where we have new discoveries are that we're now able to look at the biopsychosocial variables, and we're coming up with new ways of classifying and diagnosing patients. So we're going beyond the concept that a patient just has lower back pain or is a fibromyalgia patient or a patient with neuropathic pain. We now are able to look at a variety of signs and symptoms, pain being one, but also looking at psychological variables and history to begin to think about patients in more discrete groups.
So this is interesting. I mean, in some ways you can use big data now to, as you say lower back pain. We've got lower back pain plus low socioeconomic status and female under the – when you put all that together, you start getting groups, clusters.
Correct, and especially when we begin to add in other variables like level of anxiety, depression, concepts of somatic awareness, sensitivity to pain, we can now begin to group individual pain conditions into subgroups. And so this process of respecting the heterogeneity of a population, bringing them to more refined groups, is allowing for new diagnostic methods to come forward, new algorithms that are informing treatments. So by moving a back pain patient into, say, one of three groups, we now believe that we can begin to target therapies based on group assignment, even though we may have three lower back pain patients, each falling into different groups. The treatment can be quite different.
Well, Seema, how does that work at your end? Are these categories now, has that research gotten to you, and what would you do with it?
I would say we also want to take a patient-centered approach. Patients don't want to always be clustered. They want to know someone's listening to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, experientially, someone's pain is going to be different based on their lifestyle. Are they responsible for employment and finances in the home? What do they expect of themselves and their social roles? And that's going to vary also depending on their own individual experiences in seeking help, their experiences in their own health, you know, in different dynamics, whether it's because they have heart disease as well or they have sickle cell disease. They have different treatment teams. And you know, when it comes to pain, pain is sort of, it can be a primary diagnosis or a secondary diagnosis to other illnesses. And so when we cluster, I think depending on what factors we're using to cluster patients, it can help identify them and give them a sense of, okay, I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
But they also value someone listening specifically to them.
Well, I'm just wondering if it isn't a filtering process where you can now at least rule out a whole bunch of other things which you couldn't do when it was a patient with lower back pain. Boy, that puts them in a huge category. Now it seems to me you've filtered and now they're in a smaller group where certain therapies have been already pioneered and now you've winnowed it down. And now you're at the root. Now you really need to know this patient.
And you must listen to the patient. I think, you know, really doing a very thorough assessment of the various signs and symptoms that a patient presents with and really addressing those signs and symptoms. The issue is whether we can stratify these patients into subgroups that allow us to inform different types of behavioral therapies or pharmacotherapies. But by all means, we really need to do very detailed history and physicals And we, number one, must believe that the patient is truly experiencing a pain experience, which is shaped by their expectancies and by their life experiences.
Is this stuff getting down to the clinical level? Are we teaching this stuff in our medical schools? And do the docs all know what you're telling me?
For our clinics, I think this is common to us. But if you talk about, you know, the medical curriculum or health affairs curriculum, it's really not getting into the general curriculum for medicine, dentistry, nursing. You know, Frank, there have been a couple of really well-written studies that have shown that that medical students on average receive about 7 to 9 didactic hours on pain and pain management in their academic career. Dental students, it's about 15 hours. And veterinarians, it's about 30, 35 hours.
So fully 3 times more.
3 times. And so it's, you know, it's not surprising when someone out in the primary care community is faced with a very challenging patient, and there hasn't been a process through education to provide them with better understanding of the neural mechanisms and treatment options. And then coupled with education, the fact that our health delivery system doesn't really permit us to identify and refer patients to comprehensive care in a way that is affordable to both the individual and to institutions. So coupling the dearth in education and barriers to access to care is leading to really a huge number of chronic pain patients who really are in need.
In fact, the number is huge. Tell us how many people are suffering.
Well, you know, the 2011 Institute of Medicine report called Relieving Pain in America provides evidence that over 100 million American adults, not children, not VA soldiers, but 100 million adults suffer from some form of chronic pain. Of that 100 million, about 25 million suffer from highly impactful chronic pain, where it alters them on a near daily basis. So the cost of treating these individuals is at $635 billion a year, which is greater than the cost of treating cancer, heart disease, and diabetes combined.
Wow.
So it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem that our society faces.
Seema Pettidar, what are some of the other barriers to treatment?
I think patients' expectations are sort of a barrier. They expect it to be treated medically, and I think psychology kind of and from the start can be helpful as a collaborative approach. And I think access to care. I mean, not all psychologists are health psychologists or pain psychologists. And so some of the basic interventions, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, someone may be very proficient in. It's applying it to this health population that can be a little trickier.
Well, and it sounds like what you're saying is that the psychological and the medical need to be applied always at once. They shouldn't
from
come
the
to you
beginning.
As the last resort.
I think that's where that, you know, you were talking earlier about the pushback. This is the last resort.
Right.
That's why they think it's in my head. If it's included from the very beginning, it's considered normative and that you need to treat it from both ends, regardless of where it's coming from.
And if it goes on for too long, you mentioned this earlier, William Meixner, but I want you to maybe underscore it. The fact is that physiological changes take place if pain goes on for too long.
Yeah. So I think it's really important. I think Seema makes a very important point that so-called psychological interventions need to be implemented early. And I think that is very important because I think there's more and more recognition that there is not this separation of mind and body, that the psychological variables have a true neurochemistry, a true neurobiology behind them, and that the interventions that are applied from a behavioral perspective are very effective in changing the brain's neurochemistry. And so it's a modality, a set of modalities that we should introduce early on. And in fact, most studies show that long-term management of chronic pain is better done with behavioral interventions and psychological interventions, which change the chemistry and the architecture of the brain, the way in which the brain codes information, for example, in the amputee and that was mentioned earlier. So when there is a painful event, the brain responds to that, it adapts to that event. And in some individuals, it creates events and structure in the brain that is enduring for pain perception and also allows for easy rekindling of a pain experience. So, and that's individually determined by the genetics of the individual and their environmental history, which really shapes their expectancies and the structure of the brain.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and sometimes these behavioral patterns go on for so long, it's much harder to change them years later than at the onset of some of these difficulties. It makes it harder for people to think of it differently, to change their expectations, to have hope when this is how it's been for so long.
And just to underscore this again and to repeat what you said, when you talk about behavioral change, you're not saying it's all your fault.
It's relearning how to live with pain. And that takes experience. And pain tells you to stop.
Right.
And then the physical therapist and I are telling you to go anyway. That's hard. And it's relearning how to walk if you have an amputation. It's not feeling so scared by the pain, which naturally is going to have a fear and avoidance response, that you find a way to push through it and let the experience guide what you can do, and instead of just the fear and the thoughts and the emotions in response to pain. And so the longer you let behavioral patterns go on, the harder it is to change them, regardless of what we're talking about.
Seema Pattidar is a pain psychologist at UNC's Pain Management Center and the assistant professor of anesthesiology at UNC Chapel Hill. William Meixner is president of the American Pain Society and a professor of anesthesiology at Duke's School of Medicine. And I want to thank both of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Frank.
We've got more at our website, stateofthings.org, and more just ahead on pain. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, compared to men, women have a very different experience when it comes to getting medical treatment for pain. Nationwide, men in the ER wait about 49 minutes before receiving medication for acute abdominal pain. Women wait an average of 65 minutes for the same pain. A study done in 2003 shows that women report more severe pain levels, more frequent incidents of pain, and the pain lasts longer than men, but they are treated for pain less aggressively. Maya Dusenberry is a writer and an editor who explored pain and how the medical field treats women. Her new book is called Doing Harm: The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. Maya Dusenberry, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Tell us about, maybe we can get into this by just talking about this kind of catch-22 that women are in when they try to report pain and how it's received, you know, at the clinic or at the doctor's office.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is that we have these kind of contrasting gender stereotypes when it comes to pain. We put a lot of pressure on men to be stoic and to really kind of downplay their pain and not admit kind of any vulnerability at all. And what this leads to in the medical system is this sense that if men are reporting pain, it must be true because we assume that they're sort of reluctant to be admitting they're in pain. So if they are, we trust that it's actually there. Whereas because women are sort of considered more permitted to express their pain, they are often treated as though they're exaggerating or overstating it. And it leads to this catch-22, as you said, where if women sort of play into the stereotype and are emotional or expressing emotion or tears, they might be seen as just hysterical. But if they go the opposite route and try to be really stoic, they might be just told, well, nothing's wrong. You must not really be in pain, because we don't expect that response from women.
Right. So if you're underplaying it, it must be underplay, right?
By,
we subtract 10. And you've got some examples. You do a lot of research that's also in your book, but and many examples. Tell us the story of Maggie as an example of this kind of thing.
Yeah, Maggie had a really pretty dramatic experience. As a young college student, she started experiencing really severe abdominal pain. She went into the ER. She was initially told, you know, maybe it's just a panic attack, and really had to kind of fight to say, you know, she didn't have a history of that and this was not that. As they did tests and they started coming back negative, she sort of was told, you know, stop being hysterical, you're being dramatic. She was in and out of the hospital a few times over the course of a few days. And at a certain point, they clearly just thought that she was making up her pain entirely. So they started telling her and her mother that they thought she was just seeking painkillers. Meanwhile, her pain had gotten so severe that she at some points couldn't even speak or move. And yet she was denied painkillers until she had one test came back that indicated that there was an infection somewhere in her body. And then this switch was just flipped immediately. And suddenly she was getting pain medication, and suddenly everybody was treating her with a lot more sympathy. And she ultimately was rushed into emergency surgery when they realized that an organ in her body had ruptured, and it was her stomach. And it was, I think, a good example of sort of the various stereotypes that can come into play, where first she was seen as just anxious and then kind of dramatic and then ultimately just lying about her pain for drugs.
Right. And until they had some objective measure, her subjective report was just not going to hold water. And the more agitated she became, the more convinced they were that she's just amping it up to get us to believe her.
Exactly. That's another one of those catch-22s where basically everything that somebody might do to really kind of show, you know, it's real, I'm in a lot of pain, sort of once doctors have decided that that's not true, all of that just gets read as, you know, being hysterical.
Now, what are the objective measures that you have, that you found, that suggest that this is really gendered, that this is not just a one person's bad experience with a perhaps inexperienced medical team?
Yeah, well, I think you mentioned a couple in the intro, the statistic about how women tend to wait longer for pain medication in the ER. And a lot of my book talks about diagnostic delays in a range of conditions, from brain tumors to autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune diseases are close to my heart because my own experience was that prompted me to write this book was getting diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease where the immune system attacks the joints, which causes great pain. But in autoimmune diseases, generally, we see that patients tend to see four doctors over 4 years, and about half of them report being kind of labeled chronic complainers. And I think that does have to do with the fact that women disproportionately are affected by autoimmune diseases. They make up 75% of patients. And again, a lot of these conditions have, as a primary symptom, symptoms like pain or fatigue or dizziness or nausea or any of these kind of subjective things where you really have to trust the patient's own reports of their symptoms to believe them.
That is a startling statistic. I want to go back over that. There's quite a bit in what you just said that I'd like to unpack. 75% of autoimmune cases, women make up 75% of the autoimmune cases?
Yes.
What do you make of that? I mean, that's shocking in a way. I mean, I was shocked to see that.
Yeah, there's a clear bias towards women. And it's also, I found it shocking just how many people in general are affected. So 50 million Americans are estimated to have an autoimmune disease, which is a really quite big number. And surprising then to see how many experience these long diagnostic delays, which I think is because a lot of doctors just aren't equipped with the knowledge they need to be able to diagnose these kind of conditions pretty more effectively.
Well, you say there actually it's two related problems that cause doctors to overlook women's system. You talk about symptoms, knowledge, and trust. Talk about those two gaps.
Yeah, I lay out the problem as being about these two gaps. The knowledge gap just refers to the fact that we don't know as much about women's bodies, about how different diseases manifest themselves differently in men versus women, and about conditions that disproportionately affect women, which includes a lot of chronic pain conditions. And so doctors just aren't really equipped with the knowledge they need to be able to treat women as well as they can their male patients. And then the second problem being the trust gap, which was kind of touched on already, but this tendency to not trust women's own self-reports of their symptoms quite as much, to really kind of need that objective test saying, you know, there's an infection before you take women at their word that they're really sick. And we see this play out as a lot of women who will tell you that when they were searching for a diagnosis, they at some point were told, you know, it's just anxiety or depression or stress, which kind of covers anything, or really had their symptoms normalized, told, you know, maybe it's just menstrual cramps or maybe it's menopause or pregnancy, or otherwise just felt like they weren't being taken very seriously.
Well, and this also suggests that people in general, and maybe women in particular, don't know their own bodies. So if you come in, you know, and having experienced menses for years, and then you say, I've got this extreme pain, and they say, well, it's menstrual cramps, you think I know the difference now between what I'm reporting to you and what I've experienced for years?
But this
inability to even trust that individuals have a better sense of what's going on with them than your test might show when they show up at your office.
Yeah, exactly. It's really, I think, disorienting for women, and I think especially for kind of younger women who have been raised with an expectation that they have some authority in the world, and to go into a doctor's office and say, you know, I'm sick, I'm experiencing something that I've never experienced before in my life, and to be told, you know, yep, no, nothing's wrong just because the test came back negative.
And there's lots of good data to show that the system has a kind of a gender bias, and also hints. You used the word earlier, hysterical, which is a gendered word. I mean, there's a word that refers to female anatomy to talk about generally losing control of your emotions, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the book goes very deep kind of into the history of hysteria, you know, which was considered this real disease in the 18th, 19th centuries, and talks about the evolution that disease went through, where now we have various kind of labels that mean the same thing, this concept that symptoms are all in your head. And of course, patients aren't usually getting an official diagnosis of hysteria written in their chart. Mm. But when they're told, you know, oh, it's just anxiety, when they're reporting physical symptoms, I think it is very much that concept that allows doctors to do that.
Well, I also like the fact that in your book you pay a lot of attention to the history of Western medicine, the commodification of Western medicine with the rise of capitalism, and how that threw women out of the business and changed forever how we practice medicine.
Yeah, definitely. I was sort of surprised to learn that history myself, and kind of just realize how recently it was that the American medical profession really became a profession that had a monopoly on healing, and how there was a lot of, or there was starting to be kind of female physicians making inroads into the profession at the end of the 19th century, and then were kind of really pushed out aggressively as the male-dominated profession felt very threatened by that.
Yeah, and it became an industry and a business even earlier than that, which is when women who had pretty much had the role of healing and nurturing were kind of pushed out of the business. By the way, this does coincide with witch burning. It's a fascinating history that, if you go even deeper, is quite tantalizing. Now, the other side of that is to say, well, yeah, but your root healers, you know, weren't curing cancer, so maybe it's not such a bad thing.
I think that's true, but I think it's also true that the regular doctors who kind of took over from the traditional healers also weren't curing cancer at that point either, you know?
Well, and
they
frankly
didn't have much science to offer at that point either, so.
Yeah. And it's the blend. It's the baby that was lost with the bathwater in many cases, that by losing the patient and alienating medicine from the body, that we really have not gotten as good a result as we might. You talked to us, ovarian cancer, I think, is something that maybe, since we're talking about that, might be a good way of, again, examining this problem of gender bias in medical care.
Yeah, the story of ovarian cancer was this very symbolic tale, in my opinion. So for a long time, ovarian cancer was known as the silent killer, and it was just taught in all of the textbooks that the disease didn't cause symptoms, and at least until its very late stages, where it was, when it was too late to cure. And it wasn't until the 80s and 90s, as ovarian cancer survivors started kind of sharing their stories in the media and also joining online patient groups and talking to each other about their experiences of getting diagnosed, that they started saying, look, we disagree with this idea. We had symptoms before we diagnosed. Many of them had actually gone to doctors complaining of those symptoms, but they weren't connected to ovarian cancer. And they kind of described this really maddening circular logic where they would say, after they were diagnosed, say, oh, well, look, like that abdominal bloating and discomfort that I was experiencing must have been a symptom of this. And their doctor would say, no, that couldn't possibly be the case because ovarian cancer is a silent killer. And it wasn't until patients convinced a doctor, a gynecologic oncologist, to partner with them and do an official survey and get the results published that they were able to really overturn that myth. And now it's officially that name has been put to rest, and we have a symptom index now that is recognized. But I think it was striking to see how long that process took, because women's own individual reports of their symptoms counted for so very little until that research happened.
Yeah, I mean, it underscores two serious problems. Number one, labeling. Once you call it a silent killer, then, of course, you can't possibly have a symptom until it's too late. That backwards logic, which is, again, part of our scientific, it's in the community whether they like to acknowledge it or not. But the other part is you weren't listening to this woman. You were not listening to this person when they were telling you something is wrong, and aggressively looking into what may be the cause of this, right? Dismissing it as hysterical. So it's systemic. It's a part of a problem that is all latched into a huge economic engine that gets paid for procedures and medicine and not for outcomes. So what do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to fix in medicine, obviously. I think for me, I see a lot of potential when it comes to funding a lot of the conditions that especially impact women that have been so neglected in the research realm, and that includes many chronic pain conditions. I mean, your previous guests have noted how many people are affected by chronic pain and how little medical education doctors get. And the other big thing is just how little funding those conditions get from the NIH and other funders. So that's a really big thing. And I also think that just telling our stories as women who've experienced this kind of dismissal can be really powerful, because I think that a lot of women have the sense that these experiences are just a kind of one-off thing, you know, just the result of individual bad luck. And so they just put it down to being an unfortunate thing that happened to them. And it isn't until you start kind of talking about them and you see how common these experiences are that you can start to see, no, these are really rooted in these systemic problems and it's not just me.
Would it make a difference to have more women as doctors and as researchers?
You know, I think it would, I'm sure, for a lot of reasons, but I don't think that will be some magic bullet. I definitely think that at this point the problem is very systemic. It's about what doctors, regardless of their own gender, are learning in medical school, and it's really unconscious. It's about these unconscious biases that all of us hold from living in a culture that has stereotypes about women and men. So it's not surprising to me to in my research, I heard plenty of stories from women who were dismissed by female physicians. And I don't think that's surprising given what I believe the kind of roots of the problem are.
Maya Dusenberry is the author of Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can find out more about Maya and her book at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.